Now, it gives me great pleasure to hand over to Carla Mazewski, who is our awards committee chair, and we're really appreciative of all the hard work that Carla has put in for INSAR over many years in organizing all of these awards that are so important in showing how much the autism research community values their early career, mid-career, and lifetime contributors as well as advocates. So thank you, Carla.
Hi, I'd like to thank the rest of the awards committee, Lisa Hall, Gabriel Dichter, Susan Santangelo, and Matt Lerner, who spent many hours reading lots of dissertations and articles, and it was very exciting for all of us, though, to read this really wonderful research that's being done. We had a really tough job this year. We were supposed to pick 2 Young Investigator Awards and 2 dissertation awards. The pool was so incredible that we absolutely couldn't do that, so we have 3 winners for each category. I'm going to read you the titles of the 3 Young Investigator awardees and then ask them to come up. The awardees were Brian O'Rourke for his article on recurrent de novo mutations implicate novel genes underlying simplex autism risk that was in Nature Communications. Ryan Stevenson for his article on multisensory temporal integration in autism spectrum disorder that was in the Journal of Neuroscience, and Sarah Cassidy for her article on suicidal ideation and suicide plans or attempts in adults with Asperger's that was in Lancet Psychiatry. And I hope you take the time to look up those 3 really wonderful articles. So if you 3 could come on up. And we have an exciting new addition to the awards ceremony this year. We have 3 dissertation award winners, Vanessa Heath-Ball, Shula Green, and Catherine Stavropoulos. And this year, we asked them each to do 5-minute presentations to overview their dissertations. So this is a real test because they have to talk fast because they had very involved, really impressive dissertations. So the first one to come up will be Dr. Heath-Ball.
Thanks for all of you for coming to listen. I'm so honored to be up here and to have the opportunity to share really briefly some of the work that I've had the opportunity to take part in. So, you know, many of you, it's no surprise that there are many challenges to assessing autism symptoms and autism severity, you know, particularly because we are being referred patients and research participants across a range of ages and ability levels, many of whom are presenting with comorbid conditions or co-occurring dimensions of behavior that aren't considered to be core to the autism diagnosis, and many of whom who are also showing a lot of variability in terms of their symptom presentation and severity across their lifespan. And so the focus of my dissertation was really to try to deepen our understanding of how these factors affect measurement and the different measures that we use to assess autism symptoms, and also to try to expand the availability of different metrics that we can use to measure autism severity. And so my dissertation had 3 different studies, the first of which focused on a parent questionnaire, the social responsiveness scale. And the SRS is particularly interesting because the same questions are given to parents of children between the ages of 4 and 18, regardless of the child's intellectual or language level. And so the main finding of this study was that although developmental level did have an effect on SRS scores, it was actually behavior and emotional problems that showed the strongest relationships. And what that means is that children with elevated behavior and emotion problems but milder autism symptoms may have similar scores to children with lower behavioral problems and more severe autism symptoms. And so that makes it challenging. You know, while there's no doubt that these children maybe who have high levels or high scores on the SRS are showing high levels of impairment, it's more difficult to tease apart whether those impairments are related to autism severity or related to other kinds of problems. The second study focused on the ADOS, which is a clinician-administered measure. And although the ADOS is divided into different modules for individuals of different language levels and age, there are still strong effects on the total scores, the raw scores, of developmental level. And so previous work by Kate Gotham and colleagues has used the calibrated severity score, now called the comparison score in the ADOS-2, to reduce those effects and allow comparisons across modules. But one of the challenges of the calibrated severity score was that it combined both social affect and repetitive behaviors, and so didn't allow us to look at different levels of severity within an individual. And so the second study focused on standardizing the scores across the different domains to allow comparisons between children and adolescents of varying language levels. And finally, the third study focused on the ADOS Module 4, which is the module used with verbally fluent adults. And you know, for those of you who are familiar with ADOS, know that when the ADOS 2 was released, the Module 4 had not yet been revised to be comparable to other modules used with younger children or children with more minimal verbal skills. And so the goal of this study was to revise the ADOS algorithm to be consistent with the two domain factor structure, and the result was a revised algorithm that was more comparable to the other modules. And we were also able to calibrate the scores to reduce the developmental level effects and allow comparisons to the other ADOS modules. And so, you know, I think it's no surprise to us that you know, developmental and behavioral heterogeneity is important to consider in measurement, but I think it's particularly important to emphasize that how these different factors affect measurement differs in across different measures, and that, you know, these things are really important for us to consider when we are trying to interpret scores and, you know, what we're taking into consideration for a questionnaire versus a clinician-administered measure, you know, may differ in important ways. And so I think the really exciting part of this work is that you know, once we learn more about what factors affect measurement for a particular measure, we can use that information to make modifications to measures that already exist, that can be applied to existing data, and that can extend our opportunities to describe some of these behavioral variations in a wider range of individuals with autism. And, you know, this work has really informed current and future work to both refine measures such as the ADOS toddler module and offer standardized scores for very young children, as well as development of new measures to conduct assessments with minimally verbal adults. And so I want to end by special thanks to all of the collaborators and the various funding agencies who have supported me, and particularly my advisor, Catherine Lord. Thank you.
Okay, and now we'd like to have Shula Green come up to present her dissertation.
Hi, thank you so much to INSAR for this award. This is a really big honor. I'd also like to thank the chairs of my dissertation, Bruce Baker and Jeffrey Wood, as well as my mentors and the PIs of this research, Mirella DiPreto and Susan Buchheimer. The title of my dissertation is Functional Neuroimaging of Sensory Overresponsivity in Youth with Autism Spectrum Disorders. I'm going to give you a very, very brief overview. So the overall purpose of this research was to gain a much better understanding of the neurobiological basis of sensory overresponsivity, or SOR, which is extremely common in individuals with ASD. And this is a extreme negative response or avoidance of stimuli such as being touched, loud noises, or visually stimulating environments. This makes life much more difficult for individuals on the autism spectrum. Despite this, there's very little research in the area, possibly because this was only added very recently to the DSM criteria for autism. So we really don't have a great understanding of what SOR is. For example, do individuals with SOR actually experience stimuli differently, or do they have more difficulty inhibiting their responses to the same sensory experience? This lack of understanding is one reason that there are currently few effective interventions for SOR. I conducted two studies. The references are up here. There's one published and one in press in case you want more information. These two studies examined brain response to auditory, visual, and tactile stimuli in children and adolescents with ASD using fMRI. The first study used fairly basic sensory stimuli that were designed to be mildly aversive, so white noise and a flashing visual checkerboard. For the second study, I aimed to increase the ecological validity by using stimuli that the children and their parents had reported as being most problematic for them in the first study. So this was loud environmental sounds, in this case traffic noises, as well as a scratchy wool fabric that was rubbed on their inner wrist. The results were actually quite consistent in both studies in showing that the ASD youth have overreactive responses, both in primary sensory processing areas, as well as in areas that process salience and potential threat, such as the amygdala. In addition, their parents' reports of their SOR symptom severity was correlated with the activation in these regions. I then followed up on that to show that this overactivation is related to reduced neural habituation, both in somatosensory cortex and in the amygdala. So if you look over on the left there, that group in green is the ASD group with SOR. And I apologize that the legend, the colors, appear to have been slightly off. But the green group is the ASD group with high SOR. So what you can see is that all three groups have similar initial activation to the stimuli. And the ASD group with SOR remains high in their activation over time, whereas both the typical group and the ASD group with no SOR decrease their activation very quickly to the stimuli. Additionally, you can see on the right that group in blue is the ASD group with no SOR, and that group had negative connectivity between the amygdala and an area of the prefrontal cortex, suggesting that this group is downregulating their amygdala response to the stimuli. The ASD group with SOR, on the other hand, in green, is not showing that negative correlation, that downregulation. So I think the takeaway points here are, first of all, that youth with ASD and SOR over-respond to sensory stimuli, both in sensory processing areas and in areas that process salience and threat relevance, particularly the amygdala. SOR does not seem to be related to higher initial arousal, but rather to difficulty downregulating response and habituating to the stimuli, suggesting that one method of intervention may be to help youth cope with regulating the response to the stimuli rather than trying to change the initial sensory processing. In addition, the responses were much stronger to multiple simultaneous stimuli, also suggesting that minimizing exposure to more than one stimulus at the same time might be helpful in terms of intervention. Thank you so much.
Okay, and now we'd like to call up Catherine Stavropoulos.
I'd first and foremost like to thank all of you for being here, as well as the 2015 NSAR Dissertation Award Committee. This award means a great deal. It's a big honor, and I really appreciate it. So I'll be giving you a very brief overview of my dissertation. It's a little hard to summarize 3 years of work in 5 minutes, so please bear with me and feel free to contact me either by email or if you see me around the conference if you have any follow-up questions. Just to give you a little bit of brief background, we know that social behavior is impaired in autism, and in fact, this is a primary necessary symptom for a diagnosis. But in fact, decreased motivation to share attention and interest with others is a central deficit as well. And it's so central that it's been mentioned in both DSM-4 and DSM-5 as part of diagnostic criteria. But a question that still remains is, why is this the case? One hypothesis about this, known as the social motivation hypothesis, posits that maybe lack of social motivation in autism, which occurs because social stimuli is less rewarding for them, maybe leads to downstream social deficits. And this makes a great deal of intuitive sense if you think about the fact that maybe developing children with autism pay less attention to the social world because it's less rewarding, and what happens is they might be missing out on critical signals during developmental periods that are quite important. So the goals of my dissertation were a fewfold. Primarily, I wanted to test empirically the social motivation hypothesis using event-related potentials, or ERPs. I also wanted to make sure that reward properties were controlled between the social and non-social conditions in order to make sure I was getting a clear idea of whether it is in fact true that children with autism are less rewarded by social stimuli. And here's how I did this. I had children play a guessing game, and what happened is they made a response, there was a pause, and then there was an onset of feedback. And the primary measurement I used was a stimulus-preceding negativity component of the ERP signal, which occurs after someone makes a response, but before they get feedback about whether that response was correct or incorrect. But what I did not tell them is that, in fact, this was a block design. So all they knew is they were going to get one goldfish cracker for every correct answer. This was very exciting for kids between the age of 6 and 10. And in fact, what happened was all the correct versus incorrect responses were pre-programmed by the computer, so everyone got the same number of answers right and wrong. And in the social block of the experiment, there was a face in the center of these goldfish crackers. And the face was smiling for correct responses and frowning for incorrect responses. And for incorrect responses, the goldfish were crossed out with little X's. In the other block of the experiment, the non-social block, we actually simply took the face and scrambled it into an arrow that faced upward for correct responses and downward for incorrect responses. So I'm now going to show you the results first for the social block. So we see typically developing children here in black, and children with autism in red. And the gray area that's shaded is the area we use for statistical analysis. And what you can see here is the SPN is a negative going wave, and so what it looks like on there, even though it might be a little confusing, is that typically developing children are showing a much larger, more enhanced reward anticipatory response compared to children with autism. And the SPN is thought to index activity of the dopamine reward system as well as reward anticipation more generally. So what it looks like here is for social stimuli, typically developing children are much more anticipatory of this. They're more rewarded when they know the reward is going to include social information. But what happens when we turn to the non-social condition is, in fact, the exact opposite. So numerically, children with autism are showing a larger anticipatory response when the reward information includes non-social information or an arrow compared to their typically developing peers. So there's a couple interactions to unpack here, and I have a bar graph that might make it a little bit easier to see. We have magnitude of the response on the y-axis, and we can see a significant difference between the two groups in the face condition, such that typically developing children show a much larger response. And then within the typically developing children group, we see a difference between the two conditions. So the reward response for the face is much larger than that for the arrow. And interestingly enough, for the children with autism, it is numerically reversed, although this difference is not statistically significant. So the question now is, what do we take from this work? This is my main finding for my dissertation, although there were a few studies, and this is the biggest takeaway point, is that we do find evidence for the social motivation hypothesis. What we don't see is global reward impairment overall for children with autism. The reward anticipatory response is functioning. In fact, it may be overly functional for non-social information compared to social. And perhaps, this is a hypothesis that we plan on testing as we go forward, perhaps children with autism are so rewarded by non-social information that they're missing out on key critical social signals. So I have a great deal of thanks to give. First and foremost, UC San Diego, Dr. Leslie Carver was my mentor, as well as the rest of my dissertation committee, Laura Schreibman, Stefan Agnasteris, Stephen Hilliard, and Eric Korshane. I'm currently a postdoc at the Developmental Electrophysiology Laboratory, the McPartland Lab at the Yale Child Study Center, continuing this work. And I'm very excited to be joining the faculty of UC Riverside in the spring of 2016 to continue my research program. I'd also like to thank all participants and families, as well as my funding sources, Autism Speaks and the Autism Science Foundation. Thank you so much.
Okay, and now I'd like to present the SLIFCA RITVA Award for Innovation in Autism Research. The awards committee was joined by Connie Kasari, who represented the board and the program committee, as well as Ari RITVA in making this decision. This year, we also changed this award, so it was one award for $25,000 rather than two awards for $12,500. The award is to promote innovative research on autism spectrum disorders that will lead to novel treatments and improvements in the quality of life for individuals with ASD. This year's winner was Alex, and I'm sorry, Shevlov, Asatov for his study, Understanding the Mechanisms of IgG1's Action on Human Neurons in Health and Disorders Associated with Autism. And we hope to have him back in 2 years to present what he found from his study. Alex, are you here? Okay, I do not think he's here. So we can clap for him anyway. Congratulations, Alex. Oh, he is here. You should be here. You live in Utah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.